وسلم is reported to have said that remain mostly in the state of purity. Now here, for example, the word is tahur. So we can understand from this that either a person is always, you know, doesn't need to go for ghusl, he's always in that state of purity. But more importantly, that is something general. Most of us, or those of us who are Muslim, are normally in this state. So what could be the better meaning of this? That you always remain in this state of wudu. You are always in the state of purity, meaning that wherever you are, wherever you go, you have wudu. You have that minor ablution that you do. And you just do it for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The Holy Prophet says that by doing so, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will increase your lifespan. Simple. By making wudu, by remaining in the state of purity, that is remaining in the state of wudu, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will increase your lifespan. And because that increase is by an act of obedience and an act that was done with the intention of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, hopefully that increase of lifespan will just add blessings and mercies and bounties to the life of this person. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
In Sudan, rallyers remain on the streets in protest at the Monday military coup d'etat. They want the 2019 transition deal to be honored. On Monday, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan announced dissolving civilian rule and a state of emergency. Civilian cabinet ministers, including the prime minister, have been arrested. Soldiers have gone down at least seven protesters. General Burhan argues that a coup was justified to avoid a civil war. The coup has drawn global condemnation, and the UN Security Council is due to discuss the situation today. Now to start with, let's go to London to our correspondent, Ahmed Kabbala, and see what he has for us.
Yes, so we finally heard from the mastermind behind the coup, General Al-Burhan. He said that a new sovereign council will be formed in the next couple of days, a new prime minister will be appointed, as well as new judicial bodies. He's also said that he is committed to quote-unquote the transition to democracy, and he hopes to have elections in 2023. Now, unfortunately for him, the Sudanese people are not buying this. There's been calls for general strike, civil disobedience. The protests that have been going on since the military coup has been announced, and the people are fed up. You're seeing on social media, many people are talking about it. Sudan has been the number one trending topic, not only in Sudan, but around the world, following the news of the coup. And many people believe that this is a power grab and the new sovereign council will be handpicked to serve the military's interest. The new judicial body will be handpicked, the new prime minister will be handpicked. The prime minister, Hamdok, has been taken to an undisclosed location. And the reason why, according to Burhan's statement, he was taken there was because he refused the ultimatums given to him by the military. One of those ultimatums was to read out a pro-coup statement live on air. The prime minister refused and he was arrested. The information minister, who I interviewed this time last year for Press TV, has also been detained and taken to a undisclosed location.
I see. Ahmed, I hear that you're of Sudanese descent yourself. So how would you feel, as somebody belonging to Sudan and the people there, to see so many, coup d'etats in Sudan taking place and the military not being ready actually to let go of power and to let a civilian government to take power?
Yeah, it's extremely frustrating. Since 1956, when Sudan first got its independence, we've had three revolutions. One in 1964. Soon after that revolution, there was a military coup d'etat in 1969. We had another revolution in 1985. Soon after that, there was a military coup in 1989 when Omar al-Bashir took power. And then we had another revolution at the end of this of 2018. And once again, we saw another military coup d'etat. And it suggests that we need top-to-bottom reform in the military, because they don't see their role as strictly protecting the country, but rather governing the country. And regardless of what decade it is in Sudanese history, it seems the military want to call the shots and dictate, and are not willing to take orders from civilian-led government. And I think that this was not only predictable, but was inevitable, and it needs the Sudanese people to basically win back the gains that they made with the December 2018 revolution.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Ahmed Kabbalah, our correspondent in London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, from London, let's bring in a guest. We have publisher of the Africa Briefing, Jonathan Ofai-Ensah. Good to have you with us, Jonathan. So did this recent coup d'etat in Sudan catch you by surprise? You know, I'm asking this because there were many who were expecting this to happen.
Yes, I mean, the signs were there, judging from the mass demonstrations that took place last week and the week before. I mean, the people rightly sensed, you know, or saw the undercurrents that were going on, and sort of held preemptive demonstrations, you know, against such an eventuality. But unfortunately, you know, they couldn't help, and this coup took place on Monday. And like your correspondent said, the military staged the coup just because they wanted to dictate, you know, the pace of reforms. They wanted to dictate everything that goes on within the country. And again, they feared being exposed, because look, most of these military are tainted. You take the war in Darfur, you take other sleaze that has taken place within the economy and so on and so forth. Most of them are tainted and wanted to protect themselves. And it appeared Abdallah Hamdok, the deposed prime minister, wasn't one who was prepared to play ball with them. So the only alternative left to them was to stage this coup and get rid of Hamdok, right, and place their own hand-picked people, you know, in place. They've announced a new civilian government that will work alongside them. They've announced a planned judicial council, and all the members of these bodies are going to be handpicked by, or are going to be people who will be handpicked by this General Benham, and who will play their ball, will play their game, will work according to the dictates of the military.
Okay, now, author and journalist Robert Fantina is also joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. I should say welcome to Robert. And Robert, you know that General Burhan was supposed to cede control of the ruling council to civilian leaders in a few weeks' time. Instead, he dissolved the council. He announced a date for elections, after which he said he would hand over to an independent and fair representatives, in his own words. Now, is the military really serious about handing power over to civilian rulers? If so, why didn't they do it in a few weeks' time that they were supposed to do?
They are not serious about doing this, about handing power over to civilian leaders. If they were, as you said, they would have done it on the schedule that was agreed upon 2 years ago when the Bashar was overthrown and the coalition government was formed. But the fact that Burhan has now seized the government and is promising to have elections and hand over the government to civilians in another 2 years is not promising. It's not optimistic. This is going to be another military leadership, as the people of Sudan have had to put up with for decades before. They want democracy. They've demonstrated for democracy. It's what the people want, and it's what the government had promised to them. And now General Al-Burhan has violated that promise, and I don't believe he has any intention of respecting it at any time in the future.
Now, Jonathan, the general leading the coup d'etat is saying that he did what he did in order to avoid a civil war. Is he in the right?
He is partly right, yes, because when the civilian population started, you know, their demonstrations earlier, middle of this month, you know, up to last week or whatever. Yes, if those demonstrations had gone ahead, yes, chances were, you know, it could have escalated into some sort of a military confrontation. So in a way, he's right. But then, I believe the demonstrations by the civilian population leading up to last week also played into his hands. It was like, in my language, I can't go to Ghana. It's like, you know, when the mosquito wants to, you know, to enter your bedroom, you know, and the wind blows, it gives you the chance to enter your bedroom and bite you. So this is something that, you know, has happened in Sudan. The demonstrations actually played into General Burhan's hands to say this could deter on the pretext of avoiding a possible civil war.
Now, Robert, military leaders are saying that an election will be held in July 2023 in which power will be transferred to a civilian government. You know, multiple coup d'etats have been the stage in Sudan in the past three decades, so it makes me wonder if a peaceful transition in Sudan would ever be feasible.
It's challenging, certainly. The issues that face the Sudanese people are many and complex. This is, as you mentioned, the fourth such coup that the Sudanese nation has experienced in a relatively short amount of time. The elections could be held and could be reasonable, could be valid and democratic if the governing leaders choose to allow them to be such. General Al-Burhan does not seem to be someone who would encourage that, based on the fact that he has taken this move today, or in the last couple of days. He was scheduled to transition, the country was scheduled to transition to a civilian government next month, is something that he has now prevented, and he has pushed it off for two more years. There were, as your other commentator mentioned, problems in the nation, as there will continue to be. However, growth is not always smooth and simple, and the Sudanese people needed to get through these difficult times to begin their civilian government in November. This has now been defeated. Whether or not civilian government will come to power following elections in July of 2023 remains to be seen, but none of the evidence that has been demonstrated so far, that is represented so far, supports the idea that that will actually happen.
Okay, now let me ask Jonathan this. Jonathan, you know, the agreement between civilian and military leaders signed in 2019 was meant to push Sudan toward democracy, but it faced a number of coup attempts. So what's responsible for all of this, and is democracy possible in Sudan?
I believe democracy is possible in Sudan because the Sudanese people appear to be very politically aware. We shouldn't forget that. Before I go, we shouldn't forget that it was the people, actually, the demonstrations, the protests, or the sustained protests, demonstrations of the people that precipitated the downfall of al-Bashir. Okay, So I believe the people of Sudan, the Sudanese people, want and demand democracy. So that sheer force of their will will make sure that, aided by Western influences. Already the U.S. has suspended about $700 million of aid, okay? And if Sudan's allies in the Middle East, Qatar, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, also, you know, put some pressure on this junta, I believe they'll follow the timetable and usher in, you know, a democratic dispensation. I believe there's a light at the end of the tunnel where democracy is concerned, at least because of the sheer will of the Sudanese people, democracy will be attained in the long run.
Robert, do you see eye to eye with Jonathan, and how can we be rest assured that the military will not repeat the same scenario it did just today in 2023 when the, you know, transition is going to take place?
Be sure of that won't happen. In fact, I'm very pessimistic about the possibility of the transition to democracy in 2023 under the current military regime that has just taken over. The idea of the fact that the United States has withheld $700 million in aid, other countries may do the same, is going to make things difficult for the people of Sudan, but not necessarily for the government of Sudan. It depends on how repressive the military government chooses to be. We've seen the United States in the past cease foreign aid, issue sanctions, and so on. This has never brought about the desired result of a regime change. The United States always winds up going in militarily to overthrow governments. So I don't see that the U.S.'s withholding of foreign aid will have a significant impact on the government. It will certainly on the people, but how the government reacts to it remains to be seen. Sudan has other powerful allies that have not expressed a great amount of disapproval of this coup. I'm talking about Russia and China. They're both looking at it and cautiously, and Russian spokesmen have said that the inefficiency of the pending or the coalition government that had been in effect for a while is what caused this coup. I don't think that's the case, but I don't see Sudan's other powerful allies withdrawing from it at this time.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jonathan, speaking of the U.S., you know that the country removed Sudan from state sponsor of terror lists last year, and in June, it also paid a $50 billion debt relief package to Sudan. Now, some believe that this is aimed at kind of encouraging Sudan to sign the so-called normalization deal with the Tel Aviv regime. Your take on that?
Yes, I mean, it was a sweetener. Already, General Benham, when Netanyahu was prime minister, had trilateral talks with Netanyahu and Donald Trump. Okay, and again, Pompeo, the then U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, also called Benham to congratulate him, you know, on trying to normalize relations with Israel. Yes, I believe this normalization will happen. Already, everything has been set in motion. So I believe even it hasn't happened already, it will happen eventually. So, and to go back to the other guy in Canada, look, what I said was that the sheer force of the will of the Sudanese people will make sure, because the only resistance that the military will show will be to kill, you know, the civilians, to kill the protesters. And the more they do that, the more isolated they will be, right? And the more, you know, even their allies might turn against them. So they'll need to, the people demonstrating, asking for a return to civilian rule, will put much pressure, internal pressure, and also bring in external pressure for the military regime to make way for a democratic disposition in the long run. Maybe not in the medium term, but hopefully in the long term, in the long run, the democratic dispensation will be allowed to take place.
Okay. Now, Robert, what do you think? Will Sudan be signing normalization deal with the Tel Aviv regime? And how will the people react?
I think, as your other commentator said, that Sudan will sign the normalization. As with other countries, Arab countries that signed such normalization, of course, Sudan is an African country, but with a large Muslim population. But as other countries did, the people protested. It was not what the people in the countries wanted, but it was done for political expediency, often at the behest of the United States. Sudan will do for the same reasons, despite what the people of Sudan want. The United States will continue to fund the Sudanese government as long as it does the U.S.'s bidding. And one of the very important things to the United States is for Israel to not be marginalized in the world community, as it is increasingly due to its genocidal practices against the Palestinians, its constant violations of international law, and its crimes against humanity. The United States is willing to overlook those and will bribe other countries to overlook them too, and will probably be successful with Sudan, regardless of who is running the country.
Right. Now, one final question for both of you. Jonathan, who would benefit from a Sudan that's in disarray and chaos?
Nobody benefits. You know, the Sudanese people will lose. And I don't see anybody benefiting. I mean, it will be losses all around.
Mm-hmm. And Robert?
I agree with that. The Sudanese people will suffer from this chaos. They will be unable to get foreign aid. As we've mentioned before, many countries will probably stop foreign aid because of this coup, at least for a time, and those people will suffer. The United States may decide to go in militarily under what it will say are humanitarian causes, which is what the United States does at different times and just makes things much worse than they ever were. But in order to get any oil or to prevent exports to Russia and China, the United States may do that. So this is a lose-lose situation for everybody.
Okay, Jonathan, would you foresee a U.S. intervention in Sudan?
I don't see U.S. Intervening militarily, but maybe diplomatically to try to exert some diplomatic pressure on the military,
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this edition of The Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We had publisher of the Africa Briefing, Jonathan Ofeansa from London, and also author and journalist Robert Fantina in Kitchener, Ontario. I've been your host, Behrouz Nadefi, and I'll see you next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, higher than favor. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Gratitude is more than mere appreciation by tongue. It includes actions that demonstrate appreciation in practical terms, and it involves using each favor in a proper way. Such gratitude for a favor results in blessings and prosperity far greater than that provided by the favor itself. Using the favors for seeking Allah's pleasure
and meeting his servants' needs is capital that earns honor in this world as well as eternal prosperity in the hereafter. While a favor itself may confer only a material blessing. In other words, when one receives a favor, he receives something useful for this world, and if he shows gratitude for it in appropriate ways, he then receives something additional, which is even better. Additional rewards both for this world and the hereafter. Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam has said, "One who is grateful for a favor derives more prosperity from his gratefulness than from the favor, because favors pertain to life in this world, whereas gratitude is the capital of this world and the other world." So, brothers and sisters, we have to be grateful for all the blessings and all the favors that we receive through whoever it comes. If we are grateful, we benefit more. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing something that is higher than a favor. So let's say somebody extends his helping hand to get you out of some sort of trouble, right? You needed help, you know, just take a very simple example. Let's say you needed some money. Somebody gave you some money, right? Your problem got solved. He did a favor to you. Now this favor is to your benefit. There's no doubt about it. You benefited from that favor, got out of that trouble, and you now live a very happy life and you are all satisfied. Now, the question is, can you benefit from this favor to the next level or not? You can ask, how do I benefit from this favor even further? Well, the answer to that is through thankfulness. You know, sometimes we take things for granted. Somebody helped us, we're like, okay, yeah, I mean, you helped me, fine, whatever, and you move on. But there's another time where you're thankful for that help that you have received, for that assistance you have received. And once you're thankful towards that person, you benefit in the hereafter as well, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created the system based on human beings helping each other out and taking care of each other and thanking each other and being thankful towards each other. Somebody who has thanked another human being has in fact thanked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So as a return of this thank, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala increases in the sustenance of that person, in the blessings that that person is supposed to receive in this world and in the hereafter. So capitalize on the favors you receive from Allah or from his servants, and you benefit more in this world and the hereafter. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Iran is a land of ethnic diversity, and that is reflected in different languages, cultures, and of course, music. After over a one-year hiatus due to the coronavirus, the Iranian Folk Music Festival has once again hosted musicians from across Iran, each playing their local tunes using their indigenous instruments.
I come from the northern Khorasan province. I am so happy to be part of this music festival to share my city's music with my fellow Iranians from other cities. I've brought our local instruments, such as sornal, which is an ancient Iranian woodwind instrument, and dhol, which is a local type of drum.
We in Sistan and Baluchistan province play sitar, which we also call tambure. We also play qaychak, which is a type of a bowed lute, similar to kamanche. We usually play in celebrations.
Every night during the three-day festival, different local ensembles took to the stage to perform, so the audience could listen to Kurdish, Baluchi, Azeri, and Arabic tunes in a matter of a few hours. And this is my favorite part. On the sidelines of the festival, bands from different ethnicities get together and improvise. This is where music transcends languages and interconnects various cultures.
Music is a language that needs no translation. We may not understand each other's languages, but as you could see, different people are interacting peacefully through music.
It's so interesting to see artists from different parts of the country perform together. This is the true meaning of national unity that binds us despite our cultural differences.
Organizers say that's the main purpose of holding such an event, to unite different ethnicities through the language of music.
Music is an integral part of society's identity and history, and Iran is no exception.
So the festival tries to both introduce the local music of different ethnic groups in Iran while establishing peace and friendship among them.
Organizers also hope that the festival would help revive Iran's folk music, which has long been overshadowed by some of the heavily invested genres, like pop.
Through music, it's easier to grasp the ethnic diversity in Iran, because music itself is a language, a universal language that speaks the beauty of differences and peaceful coexistence of different cultures as one nation. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Kerman.
The sanctions by the United Nations Security Council against North Korea over its nuclear and missile programs have been in place for more than a decade. The UN now acknowledges that the U.S.-backed sanctions were at least partly responsible for North Korea's food and medicine shortages.
DPR Korea has never been more isolated from the international community than at this point in time. This is having a dramatic impact on the human rights of the people inside of the country and dampens hopes of achieving sustainable peace and security on the Korean Peninsula.
The special rapporteur was echoing and backed the call by some member states for sanctions relief for North Korea.
There must be a move back towards the spirit of multilateral cooperation that enabled the foundation of the United Nations in the first place.
This weekend, the South Korean and U.S. envoys on North Korea met in Seoul, with South Korea calling for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War, and the U.S. agreeing to discuss the proposal later. The U.S. has often repeated that it's willing to meet with North Korea anywhere, anytime, without preconditions. U.S. officials have now added that the country holds no hostile intent toward North Korea, while at the same time pressing for stronger implementation of the controversial United Nations Security Council sanctions. South Koreans expressed their hope the international community could at least provide humanitarian aid.
The United Nations need to support North Koreans so that they don't continue to suffer from starvation.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in has sought to build peace with North Korea, arranging summits and proposing other avenues of engagement, while the U.S. maintained a hard line. President Moon will leave office next spring. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A Yemeni human rights group called the Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has released a report on casualties caused by 6 years of Saudi-led war on Yemen. The report says more than 44,000 civilians have been killed or injured since 2015, when Riyadh launched an aggression against Sana'a. Thousands of women and children are among the victims, according to the report.
We released a report on the casualties of the Yemen war during the past 2,400 days of the conflict. 44,221 civilians were killed or injured, targeted by airstrikes and cluster bombs. More than 4,000 children and 2,800 women are among the victims who lost their lives.
Also, hundreds have been left with permanent disabilities. The report says thousands of civilian facilities were also targeted by the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes. Hospitals, schools, and power stations were bombed across Yemen, affecting lives of millions of Yemenis in a country already hit hard by poverty.
The Saudi-led coalition has deliberately targeted civilian facilities to kill civilians. It did not differentiate between civilian and military targets. The coalition has violated international laws that ban military attacks on civilian facilities.
However, infrastructure are not the only civilian targets hit by Saudi and coalition warplanes. According to the report, more than 500,000 homes have been destroyed during the war. As a result, millions of Yemenis have been displaced across the country.
The ongoing Saudi war and the blockade imposed on Yemen is killing more Yemenis, as it has deprived millions of civilians, including children, of their basic needs, such as food and medicine. However, the international community remains silent, regardless of the situation in Yemen, which the United Nations describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Human rights organizations warn that the long-term Israeli blockade has led to deterioration of water crisis in Gaza, making the enclave's water undrinkable. The organizations also said the crisis has led to poisoning of the residents of the besieged enclave. The situation was exacerbated by an acute electricity crisis that hampered the operation of water wells and sewage treatment plants, leading about 80% of Gaza's untreated sewage to be discharged into the sea, while 20% seeps into underground water.
We suffer from shortage of water. Sometimes we are without water for weeks. Meanwhile, the available water is very salty, polluted, and unfit for daily uses, especially in the refugee camps. Palestinians here are forced to buy mineral water for drinking, but only a few of them can afford having it.
Israel's attacks on Gaza last May have doubled the crisis, as the attacks pounded the enclave's already crumbling infrastructure. This presents a serious threat to the Gaza population's health, where recent data indicates that about a quarter of the diseases spread in Gaza are caused by water pollution, and a great number of deaths of young children and infants are linked to intestinal diseases related to polluted water.
Many children and elderly people are suffering from serious diseases due to the polluted water. Most of the families here go to hospitals on a weekly basis as they have kidney problems. We call on the International Human Rights Organization to support us.
The human rights groups also warn that the water crisis will lead to a catastrophe for the health system in the Gaza Strip, and called on the international community to pressurize Israel in order to guarantee Gazans' right to water security.
There are three centers for treating water in Gaza which need fuel. We can provide only 35% of the required amount of drinking water. The residents of Gaza cannot drink the water. Our underground water is also polluted and unfit for drinking, and most of the time we are forced to buy water.
Israel has deprived Palestinians of benefiting from the natural resources of water, which has led to a serious water security crisis in the Gaza Strip. The shortage of water is threatening the lives of 2 million Palestinians and has doubled the burden on the health system in the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Recent developments in Afghanistan have marginalized attention to coronavirus crisis in the country. In the meantime, officials and doctors at Kabul's Afghan Japan COVID-19 hospital say new money has been paid to the hospital, pushing it further towards a closure.
We have many problems as the cold season is approaching. We expect another wave of the virus in coming weeks. We ask our ex-donors to pay the salaries of the employees. We can't run the hospitals on our own. If their assistance is not resumed, the only COVID-19 hospital of Afghanistan will close.
Patients getting treatment in the hospital complain about insufficient medical supplies and care, urging the international bodies to save the hospital from closing, and so the lives of Afghans.
My father has contracted the coronavirus. We are here for weeks. Everything seemed okay, but today we see that the hospital suffers from lack of oxygen and medicines. Meanwhile, the doctors have not been paid for months.
This comes as the U.S. insists on freezing nearly $9.5 billion in assets belonging to the Afghan Central Bank and stopped shipment of cash to the nation. The U.S. says the assets will not be available to the Taliban, which remains on the Treasury Department's sanctions designation list. In addition to many humanitarian crises, the halt in global aid and the freezing of Afghanistan's assets have led to closure of most COVID-19 hospitals in the country. This comes amid warnings that Afghanistan could face COVID-19 outbreaks in the coming year. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Protecting press freedom. Supporters of the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange marching all the way to the British Royal Courts of Justice today ahead of an upcoming extradition hearing. The starting point, the BBC headquarters.
one of the main issues that we have with Assange is that his extradition, the case which is being heard next week, the whole basis of the case, the facts about the case, most of this never gets anywhere near the British media.
The US government is attempting to extradite Assange under an old treaty with the UK for publishing damning documents of US war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and human rights violations elsewhere. His supporters say the charges are politically motivated.
It means basically that every journalist anywhere in the world has to be afraid of a possible extradition, especially if he is reporting on national security issues, not just by the United States or other Western countries, but by any country.
Just last month, it was revealed that in 2017, as Assange began his fifth year holdup in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, the U.S. government plotted to kidnap or assassinate him on British soil. Still, the U.K. is carrying on with his trial.
It besmirches a reputation which at least the British establishment think they have got internationally. It's supposed to be a beacon of free speech. It's supposed to be a beacon of the free press. And while Julian Assange is in Belmarsh.
Since he was evicted from the Ecuadorian embassy 2 years ago, Assange has been languishing in a maximum security prison in southeast London. His next court hearing is set for October 27th and 28th. If extradited, he'll face 175 years in a U.S. prison.
It'll be a watershed moment in the most important press freedom case of the century. And these protesters say they're hoping that the U.K. government and justice system will do the right thing and put an end to what they describe as the show trial of Julian Assange. Saeed Purizab, London.
In a press conference held by the Sudanese pro-civilian rule factions, the Force of Freedom and Change factions, FFC, has categorically rejected any move to dissolve the government without consent of the factions and Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. Meanwhile, an unarmed group stormed the building of the Sudan news agency SUNA and used physical and verbal violence to terrorize journalists and media professionals in an attempt to prevent the convening of the conference, which had been announced earlier by FFC.
We in the Forces of Freedom and Change affirm our continuous support for Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and his government, who were chosen by the FFC to lead the transition in Sudan, and we reaffirm our full support and coordination with him.
Sudan has been grappling with the biggest political crisis in its 2 years old transition. The military and civilian groups have been sharing power in troubled alliance since long-standing President Omar al-Bashir was ousted in 2019. Observers believe that the only way out for Sudan's current crisis through expanding base of participation and unification of revolutionary forces.
I assure that there is no way out of this crisis without expanding the base of participation and rearranging the internal conditions of the forces of the Sudanese revolution as the guarantor of any real transformation in the political scene.
On the other hand, protesters from the splinter FFC faction, the National Charter Alliance, have been holding a sit-in outside Khartoum's presidential palace for the seventh day, with soldiers around the site providing protection.
Time is running out for all government components without reaching a solution for the political crisis, while FCC rejects all the mediation and solution made by the military before handing over the power to the civilian next month. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
A new poll shows that 3 out of every 4 French people believes that their purchasing power has diminished due to rising inflation, and 90% of the nation is worried about it. The nation's economy minister departed from his Western peers by admitting that inflation will continue to rise until 2023 at the earliest. Combined with unemployment, which was entrenched even before the coronavirus recession, the admission seems to announce the beginning of dreaded stagflation.
La vie est chère et encore plus à Paris.
Life is expensive, especially in Paris, from real estate to basic shopping needs to even the price of a simple lunch. Our purchasing power keeps going down.
The government has just announced a cap on household gas prices until the end of 2022. natural gas has soared to record highs across Europe. They also announced a one-time payment of 100 euros to those who earn less than 2,000 euros per month, which amounts to 60% of the population. However, many say the one-off payment is not nearly enough.
Ça devient compliqué, ça diminue fortement.
No, it's not enough at all. When somebody is only taking home 2,000 euros a month, 100 euros isn't nearly enough to make difference when it comes to the energy costs. The government is not helping the middle class much at all.
The Yellow Vest protests, which initially kicked off 3 years ago due to rising fuel prices, just began what they called Season 2 last weekend. They are promising to continue marching. By a huge margin, purchasing power is the number one issue ahead of France's presidential election next year, just as it has been in all the elections since the great financial crisis began.
It's really fragile right now. The middle class just isn't seeing a fair relationship between their work and the amount they are paid.
Inflation is being reported seemingly worldwide, as the coronavirus lockdowns may have created a monetary monster. Many economists say the only solutions are controls on prices, as well as corporate profits, and higher wages, which have remained stagnant across the West for decades. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
This was the first face-to-face meeting of EU leaders since the bloc's energy crisis really came to the fore. Millions of citizens simply don't have the money to pay for electricity and gas bills, which have skyrocketed since the start of the year.
We will intensify our outreach to the different suppliers, also to diversify the supply we do have, and we have to speed up the work on interconnections.
Experts say Iran, with its enormous oil and gas reserves, is an obvious option for the EU. Illegal US sanctions are hampering exports, but that will change if the Iran nuclear deal is revived.
The real game changers will be if Iran comes into international market with full force, increasing its oil exports, increasing its gas production.
It has been confirmed that during their summit on Thursday and Friday, EU leaders debated erecting barbed wire along the bloc's external border to manage the refugee crisis, made worse by the situation in Afghanistan. Ursula von der Leyen says the idea is out of the question. On the subject of COVID-19, the EU has failed to convince citizens in some countries to take the vaccine. For example, the virus is now out of control in Romania and Bulgaria.
Some difficulties that are related to the vaccination hesitancy, and it's why it's also important to cooperate, to coordinate, in order to make also progress on this challenge.
Some EU nations want funding cut to Poland over alleged rule of law breaches. Right-wing leaders, such as Hungary's Viktor Orban, are dead against the move, though.
There is no need to have any sanction. It's ridiculous.
Germany's Angela Merkel, who gave her last press conference at an EU leaders summit before leaving office, says she's also opposed to legal action against Warsaw. Apart from not meeting the needs of citizens and in turn allowing populism to take hold, critics say another key reason the EU is facing rule of law issues is because those running the project have been too eager to expand at all costs to create a superstate, and in the process have allowed countries to join that do not share EU values. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In the limelight.
Administrative detention is permitted under international law, but only within the confines of extreme circumstances related to a national emergency and security purposes. The Zionist regime abuses this reasoning by declaring it is in an ongoing, that is, perpetual state of emergency. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Boxbaum, journalist. This article is published under the heading Palestinian Prisoners Under Zionist Regime Administrative Detention Continue Long and Brutal Hunger Strikes. Stay tuned for more. Palestinian prisoner Meqdad al-Khawasme has entered his 86th day on hunger strike. He is overcome with weakness and can't move from his hospital bed, not even to shower or use the bathroom. He suffers from joint, kidney, head, bone, muscular, and abdominal pain. He has trouble speaking and has lost more than 75 pounds. Despite his deteriorating health, Al-Khawasme won't end his hunger strike, as he and six other prisoners refuse food in protest of their ongoing administrative detention by the fake regime of Israel. Kayet Fasfus has been on hunger strike for 92 days. Ala al-Araj has spent 68 days without food. Hisham Abu Hawash started his hunger strike 61 days ago. Rayek Barat hasn't eaten for 56 days. Shadi Abu Akar is now in his 52nd day without food. And Hassan Shuka has been on hunger strike for 27 days. Additionally, at least 250 prisoners associated with the Islamic Jihad organization began a hunger strike on October 13th in protest of their relocation to isolated cells. The Zionist regime Supreme Court froze the detentions of both Al-Khawasme and Fasfus owing to their declining health. Al-Khawasme was detained on January 2nd and Fasfus was detained in July 2020. However, the prisoners' relatives and Palestinian government organizations say the Zionist regime decision isn't coming from a place of morality, but rather from liability concerns. The commission added that Fasfus's health is worsening with each day. The 32-year-old is persistently dizzy, has severe fatigue and chest pain, and his blood pressure and blood sugar levels are low. Fasfus also refuses to take supplements or undergo medical tests, saying he didn't suffer from health problems or illnesses prior to his arrest. Fasfus and Al-Khawasme were transferred from prison clinics to the Zionist regime hospitals. Al-Khawasme's mother, Hazm, told Mint Press News that the family received a permit to enter the occupied lands. The Israeli regime prison service wants to relieve their responsibility from his life in case anything happens, Hazm said. It's not a human rights thing, she added. The Zionist regime's policy of administrative detention allows it to imprison individuals indefinitely on secret information without charging them or allowing them to stand trial for a period of 6 months, with the possibility of renewal. Neither the detainee nor his attorney can access the classified evidence. While Israelis and foreigners can also be subject to administrative detention, the practice is mostly used against Palestinians. In September, Palestinian prisoner rights organization Adamir sent an urgent appeal to the United Nations to intervene and pressure the Zionist regime to end administrative detention. Adamir's letter emphasized the fact that administrative detentions have spiked recently. Milena Ansari, Adamir's international advocacy officer, said, "The Israeli regime occupation's use of administrative detention has drastically increased, especially this year, where arbitrary detention has been a key feature to maintain control over the Palestinians, especially with regards to what was happening in Al-Quds, Sheikh Jarrah, in the West Bank, and especially with the escape of six Palestinian prisoners from Gibola prison." In 2020, the Zionist regime issued at least 1,114 administrative detention orders against Palestinians, while no less than 759 administrative detention orders were issued from January through June 2021. Currently, 520 Palestinians